present our annual report. With myself, my name is Thembiwe Madamosu. I'm the Chief Executive Officer of the Independent Development Trust. With me is my executive team and a member of the Board of Trustees, Mr. Shoaib Chaklis, who's sitting over there. He was saying earlier he's a brand new Board of Trustees, so also extends to the public works. Not sure whether it is my responsibility, but next to Pinky is Mandisa. Mandisa is from the Office of the Director General, and she is responsible for the strategy development. I wasn't sure whether I should.
Okay, we may continue with the presentation, please. I hope this side we know, honorable members. Is there a need for us to go through the same process? Yes. I will then request honorable members to identify themselves. My name is Tandi Tobias. I'm the chairperson of the portfolio committee, the new chairperson of the portfolio committee.
My name is Doris Mwan. I'm a member of the portfolio committee.
Fucking long, sorry.
Should you offer me?
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Can we continue, Ms. Tembe?
Okay, thanks.
Chairperson, once more, thank you for the opportunity. As part of the oversight role of the committee, we will be presenting to yourself the annual report of the Independent Development Trust covering the financial year 2006-2007. I will start with the first presentation, with the first slide, which will be talking into the declaration of our compliance, and that is how we submit our compliance documents to the oversight bodies that we account to, which would include the portfolio committee, of course. A month before the start of the financial year, we do lodge our corporate plan with the executive authority, which is the Minister of Public Works, and that was done timely. 21 days after that, after the end of each quarter, we do submit quarterly performance reports to the executive authority. We negotiated with the executive authority to allow us to submit on the 31st of each month, so that is a few days after the 21 days. The reason being, honorable members, that when we close up a month, the 15 days after the close of month is actually the collation of the information. And quite often we realize that we submit the report to the executive authority without having vetted the report. And quite often we correct some of the mistakes in the report after it has been submitted because we are chasing the deadline. What we then did was to go to the portfolio, to the executive authority and request that we be given another 7 days just to allow also the chairperson of the board and ourselves to vet for the report. And that is what we have agreed on the shareholder complex. On the 31st of May 2007, the trustee report and draft financial statement were presented to the Auditor General. As you are aware, honorable members, that we do have an interim audit report around the end of the year, and the final one then is submitted on the 31st of May of each year, and that was submitted timely as well. On the 31st of July 2007, we received the AG's audit report, which I will be talking to in the next slide. And on the 30th of August, we lodged our annual report with the executive authority. We were abreast of the fact that portfolio committees now require the minister to actually submit a covering letter concerning that we have been able to present that annual report to the minister. What we also do from a process point of view is that we do have our bilaterals with the minister and the chairperson of the board where we present this document to the minister before she presents it to the portfolio committee. On the 29th of September, our annual report was therefore tabled in Parliament by the minister. The opening statements that you will see on pages 7 to 13 will be talking to our vision, mission, and the core business areas. And just to confirm, honorable members, that those founding statements have not changed. But you will see in the next financial year, as we present to yourselves, that we'll sort of tweak the vision of the organization. And I will be talking to that again as I move on with my presentation. And that was a result of interactions between ourselves, the executive authority, and some of the shifts that we have incorporated in our new corporate plan. Honorable members are aware that we did have a new executive authority as well, which was the Minister of Public Works, Honorable Didiza, who joined us, was it May, June? I think around that time, that was after the passing of Minister Bugao. One of the things that we have been focusing on has really been to cement that relationship and the understanding of how the minister expects things to be done as an executive authority. And I think we have been able to achieve that. We've got all our compliance documents signed by the minister, including the shareholders' compact, which is a contractual agreement in terms of the performance of the organization and the expectations of the minister. We recognize the organization's performance, in particular our PIA program, that was our program implementing, is a program implementing agent. That is an acronym that we will be using, which refers to that in terms of programs, the ASGISA, and the MAS Schools Initiative and the Anti-Poverty Strategy. I will be talking to some of these programs, but just highlighting some of the issues that we've been interacting with the minister on extensively. And of course, the fact that in this financial year, it is for the fifth successive year that we've been getting an unqualified audit report. And I will be talking to that in detail as well. We have had, during that period, an acting chairperson after our previous chairperson, Mr. Mzima, resigned due to other engagements within the law fraternity. And therefore, he was released of his responsibility, and Mrs. Khadde started acting. All these are the changes that are reflected in our annual report, and which then resulted into the extension of the term of office of the board. As honourable members are aware that our board's term of office is normally 4 years, but I think with the current board they went beyond that, given the transition of the passing of the minister and the coming in of the new minister, who then wanted to be involved in the selection of the board. So that period overlapped a bit. One of the other things that we looked into was the long-term sustainability of the organization, including, of course, the business case on the sustainability model, which is something that we have been interacting with the board, and we also presented to the portfolio committee before. You will see that in the trustees statement in our annual report, the trustees pride themselves in serving the nation through the IDC and the performance of the organization. And that, in many ways, has been reflected by the outgoing board. The trustees report, which is on page 17 to page 27, will be looking into the issues of compliance, and that is the number of meetings that we've had, the board meetings, that have taken place during the reporting period, the mandate of the IDC, which had not changed, but it was more refocused by the executive authority when she came on board. The corporate governance issues, the executive authority, which I have spoken to briefly, the reporting to Parliament, I think we've been able to honour all our reporting obligations within Parliament in the past year, and of course the function of the board and the committees of the board. The financial management and resources, we will be talking to that, and my CFO will be elaborating on some of the figures that has been presented, and if honourable members have got specific issues on which they want us to pay a bit more attention, we will be able to unpack that. Our risk management strategy, the trustees' attendance, and the trustees' and executive remuneration is also disclosed in the report. Here I will be looking into the performance report, and that is the report of the chief executive officer, and this is tabled in the report, and that is from pages 31 to 33. Mainly there you will see that we have articulated the corporate performance metrics, which is on those pages that are reflected there, and that metric really is beginning to reflect to yourself how we have sort of disintegrated our corporate targets, our objectives, and the measurability of what we have implemented over the time. The performance against each strategic objective is on pages 39 to 51. In the CEO's report, one of the things that I am reflecting in that report is that this current financial year report, coincidentally, is the 1,000 days of my tenure within the IDC, which, as I started the IDC, there were very specific strategic focus areas that I was looking at, which I can be able to say that the organization has been turned around and is in a stable position right now. Yes, honorable members, I am going to acknowledge that there's still a lot to be done to get it to the most ideal, but I think there has been a lot of improvement in that. And the key achievements that I'm highlighting there, for instance, is the 1 billion program expenditure that we achieved in this financial year. Honorable members will recall that throughout our previous years, our average expenditure has been around 600 million. And you'd find that quite often we do have some rollover. But the way that we have managed even our agreements with departments in terms of our program implementation agreements, and as well as our expenditure rate, has been able to enable us to spend about a billion rand last year, which for us was a real stretch target. And we're very proud that at least we've been able to get to that. I am aware that in the previous financial years, there were some concerns that were raised by honorable members in as far as the rollovers and the perceived dumping of finances into the IDC by department, which this expenditure has started resolving those challenges that we have indicated. We also undertook or supported an NGO organization into the Chile Tunisia study tour and the impact thereof. This for us has been a very successful intervention, particularly in as far as taking the anti-poverty strategic approaches of this country. We have been able to present our report to quite a number of forums, and we are quite happy that it has been very influential in the development of the anti-poverty strategy of this country. There is a DFI review process, which I'm hoping that honourable members are aware of, and this is the process that is led by the department, by the Treasury Department, to review the parastatals of government. I think it's quite a bit of an oldish project, but it took off and gained momentum during the past financial year. In as far as the IDT is concerned, our processes have been concluded, but the cabinet has not yet been able to consider the report that the consultants are putting forward. I will be talking to that also in detail. The performance salary against government development policy objectives is articulated on pages 34 to 37, and there is also an informative summary that we have put up on that. Maybe just to look into our strategic objectives, honourable members, and to say that you will notice that when we reported to yourselves in the previous financial year and this financial year, there is a bit of tweaking in the way in which we have reported. And that is informed by the interactions and with our executive authority, who indicated that she would prefer that as we put up our corporate plan, in terms of the specific targets within the corporate plan, those be articulated in our business plan and as well as in our scorecard. Her approach into that is in a way in response to the 10-year review to say that we need to begin to measure ourselves from an outcome point of view rather than the output and the figures. Hence, you would see that our reporting has at corporate level emphasized more of the output, of the outcome type of target, and then we have articulated that into our business plan and the specific output as we go along. So therefore, our long-term strategic goal would be to provide innovative development solutions to advance poverty eradication, and that is our first strategic objective. As I have said, you'll see that the measurement on that is very much outcome-driven. It is the so what question that we're trying to respond to. To say all our interventions ultimately in this particular strategic objective, they need to be responding to innovative development solutions that will advance poverty eradication. The second, the long-term strategic objective would be to impact on absolute poverty through innovative and best practice models in the provision of comprehensive development programs. What this also means is that our program should not just be we have put in a school, but rather to say how have we reduced the levels of illiteracy in that particular area? How has this school impacted on the quality life of those people? Has it really improved that? So we are beginning to endeavor to measure ourselves differently from saying it is X number of facilities that were put in, but rather to say this is how it has impacted on that. And this is also in response to what our executive authority has been articulating to us. In terms of long-term outcome, it's the reduction in poverty and unemployment in areas where the IDP operates. You'll also see the alignment of this outcome indicator on our progress that we are implementing. The short-term goal would be to deliver comprehensive infrastructure and other development programs in a way that improves the quality of the lives of target groups. Again, when you look into our targets and our actual projects that we implement, you will see that we are emphasizing that we do need infrastructure, because through infrastructure we can be able to engage the communities that we interact with from a job creation point of view, from a capacity point of view, and also from an economic activity point of view. The performance of the strategic objective, as I have indicated, is that we did spend about slightly more than R1 billion. In terms of expenditure in the reporting period. We built about 770 classrooms, which may gain access to 30,800 learners. We also constructed 74 health facilities that benefited 740,000 persons. This is how we sort of try to articulate or to measure the impact of our interventions, to say this particular clinic, at least it has contributed to this number of people, given the profile of that area where that facility is. The transformation of program management environment, and for us that has been an achievement in quite a number of ways, and I will give some examples. For instance, we have been able to map out our business processes, what we refer to as our business process re-engineering, which has really been trying to transform the whole program management environment to a much more efficient way of service delivery, and that would entail the speeding up of payments. Honorable members would agree with me to say one of the biggest challenges that small SMMEs have been having on the ground is the late payment in terms of the project that they implement, which really affects their sustainability as small businesses. And we've improved that. I mean, we've moved from something like 2 month payment period to about 48 hours turnaround time in terms of the processes of those payments. A customized monitoring tool for all our programs. And again, this is to acknowledge upfront that we ourselves were aware that in terms of our monitoring tools, they were very manual, and as such, the risk of some issues falling through the cracks is actually there. What we have now done is to put in what we refer to as a dashboard, that within each of the program managers, you can be able with a click of a button to monitor all the projects that are being implemented. And we think that will improve our monitoring processes. I think our biggest challenge has been, once you can balance finances against expenditure, but there's also a project on the ground that you need to be aligning to. So this particular tool then enables us to pull in the whole management information system from the expenditure level to the actual implementation on the ground. We have also been able to finalize the beneficiary information management system, and this is a system that enables us to record all the beneficiaries of our program. For instance, if I could give an example with the extended public works program, there are quite a number of people that we interact with that are participating from that program point of view. But one of the weaknesses that we've had is that after the EPWP has been finished, we're unable to track back what has happened to those people. And when there's a new project that comes in, you find that we're unable to go back and pull those people in. And if we also recognize the fact that one of the biggest advantages of the EPWP of South Africa is the learnership program, the fact that people must be put through a learning process over a period of at least 9 months. Now, if you don't have a beneficiary information management system, you're unable to track that, because some of the projects would be a three-month project, a six-month project, which means have not finished the nine-month project. What this system assists us to do is that we're able to go back to the beneficiaries and enable them to finish their learnership program, which we believe improves their employability in the future or even starting their own program. Also, the percentage of infrastructure programs spent invested locally within the communities that we work with. We also pride ourselves in this, in the fact that we are saying almost all our programs, the communities that we work with, we spend the money there in those communities, be it on bricks, be it on the actual construction, be it on the furniture that sometimes is supplied to the school. We try to utilize that. Hence, our capacity building intervention prior to the implementation of the program plays a critical role. For us, this is a very important element, honorable members, because I think this is what distinguishes us from Marian Roberts or any other construction company that can come and build a school. It's the fact that we want to be measured by the impact that we make in those communities in as far as contributing to the quality of life of the people that we work with. The positioning of the organization, I think that as we go through the report, you will see how that is being articulated. Our strategic objective two, in terms of the long-term strategic goal, is to strengthen the developmental state through deepening democracy in targeted localities. And there, again, we are referring to the local area plan. Honorable members will again agree that we do have IDPs in local municipalities, but quite often those IDPs have not necessarily been able to mobilize the communities themselves. We want to say that if in a municipality an IDP is successful, each and every community of that municipality should be able to say, these are the priorities of the municipality. This is what will be delivered at this time. And we think that will reduce even the unrest that we see among communities, where you find that there's a disjunction, because communities don't know what to expect and when that will come. But if we can bridge that gap, we think there will be a better way of implementing our program. So our local area plan is a social facilitation tool that the local government is also utilizing to enhance the IDPs. That is, you take the IDPs to the people, discuss that, and reprioritize so that the people know what is it that is sitting in those IDPs. For instance, if the IDP is saying we are going to construct 200,000 houses, people know that my time will come in the next 200. So the expectations and the actual delivery is in a way mitigated. We're saying from a long-term strategic objective is to promote people-centered development. Again, this is our methodological approach, where we believe that the participation of our beneficiaries and the communities that we work with is what will be able to enable us to reach that intended outcome. The long-term outcome is empower citizens in areas where the IDP operates. We endeavor to say that where we have operated, there should be a footprint. You should be able to say the IDP should have passed through this particular area, because those communities will be empowered and those communities would have participated in the implementation of those programs. In terms of short-term goals, is to design and implement diverse strategies to strengthen people-centered development, targeting 10% of project consolidation municipalities in KZN, Western Cape, and Limpopo. Here it's more of a financial constraint to say These are the interventions that the IDT implements with our own resources. No one funds us. There's no department that gives us money to implement the LAP. But we fund that from our own capital base. Hence, therefore, in terms of our reach, the magnitude of our reach, we had to sort of isolate a few of those municipalities. And we said within the project consolidate municipalities, we will isolate about 10 of that and deepen the interventions that are already taking place within project consolidation. The performance of strategic objectives 2, as I have said, we've got the local area plan, which is IDT design methodology. We deliver this beyond our targets. As I have said, this is not the budget that we get from department. And we're proud to say that our LAP has been adopted by almost all the municipalities. The ADISA, which is the Jobs for Growth Skills Acquisition and Placement Program. A bit of a background on this, that honorable members are aware that we were requested as IDT to implement the second economic intervention of the ADISA program. And within that, we have got this program, which is the Jobs for Growth program and the Skills Acquisition program. We did conceptualize and design the delivery mechanism for this program. We have trained about 205 CPOs. We've facilitated 651 international placements. And this international placement relates to the GIPSA program. As honorable members are aware that the GIPSA secretariat does the policy, does the negotiations, but the actual placement, the implementation of those placements is within the IDT. We also conceptualized other delivery models that included the empowerment model of capacity building, social facilitation framework, the business case for multiple programs, and we have also consolidated our partnership with civil society, which will include the South African Women in Dialogue. The strategic objective 3, the long-term strategic goal, is to contribute to African development solutions. And we said on a long-term strategic objective is to position the IDT as a best practice and development agency capable of serving national and regional development agendas. Our long-term outcome was to promote NEPAD objectives, and our short-term goal was to design a strategy for participation in the NEPAD program. There has been a bit of a challenge in the current strategic objective is concerned, as the honorable members are aware that within the country, from a strategic point of view, there is no focus a strategy that you can say this is a NEPAD and we can measure against that. And as we were trying to explore, to look into what our role will be within that strategic focus of NEPAD, we realized that we're unable to really put our hands onto it. When the new executive authority joined the IDC, joined the public works family, one of the things that she assisted us with was actually to introspect our participation into NEPAD. We then agreed that we cannot put an objective like NEPAD participation in the concrete terms in which we had done, but rather look into how we would be able to interact with other African countries, either from a knowledge sharing point of view or from other activities. And that is what we had done. Hence, there was the study tour to Tunisia that I referred to earlier, which was more of a dialogue between the Tunisian women on how they have been able to eradicate poverty. The location or the selection of Tunisia, in particular in Chile, was because these are the two countries that have exceeded the achievement of the Millennium Development Goals. So our interest was to look into what is it that they did differently that we could learn from and bring into South Africa.
So the indigenous dance?
Yes, they did. Actually, they split the whole world in as far as the MDGs are concerned. It is these two countries that have exceeded the achievements of the MDGs. And when you look into the economies, they are also middle income economies. And when you look into their historical background, their political background, you would realize that they've actually come out of almost similar situations in South Africa. So we felt maybe we can learn from that. And I think we have learned a lot of lessons from that. If honorable members have an interest in that document, we can send you the document and even interact with you in as far as that is concerned. Our strategic objective 4 in terms of long-term strategic goals is to gear the organization's resources towards excellence in delivery, and the long-term strategic objective is to institutionalize and sustain effective and efficient internal business processes. Long-term outcome, the IDT is an effective, efficient, and accountable public entity. We endeavor to achieve that. And as a short-term goal, the organization sustains and delivers an unqualified financial and non-financial audit report. This strategic objective is mainly looking into our processes, efficiency, more than anything. And as you can see, that in terms of our 2008-10 MTEF, the corporate and the corporate strategy, we have reinterpreted our mandate, which we were guided again by the executive authority, and we think that it is somehow a bit more focused and much more precise. I think the minister challenged us to say, yes, why is the IDT or department could be demanding that the IDT intervene into a diversified portfolio of programs. I would like the IDT to be more focused. So you see, for instance, the geographic focus on rural areas, the targeting of women in particular, has been some of the focus areas that we have brought into our strategic objectives. The strengthened policy environment. We have been able to approve about 13 policies, and again, I know this might be a very interesting element to honorable members why the IDT would only approve 13 policies now. What has been happening is that we have been having frameworks of operation. Like, for instance, in terms of if I would give an example on our planning processes, we know very well when our planning cycle starts, what are the issues that come into that. So we had that implementation framework, but we're not reduced it into a policy. Our interaction with the Auditor General was to say, take these frameworks and reduce them into policies. So it was more the documentation of that and taking it through the processes for approval. So what we did, our target was to make sure that by the time the audit starts, we've documented all those policies. But those were frameworks that had already been existing within the organization. So we have approved all these policies. At some stage, I think when we're doing the interim report, those were drafts. But by the end of the financial year, when we submitted to the Auditor General, these were approved policies. We have transformed our systems through what we refer to as the Kitimang Project, which is really the business process re-engineering and revisiting our own systems and trying to enhance the utilization of those systems. We're also proud to say that we are coming to this portfolio committee with 100% with all our executive posts filled. I know that the committee was quite concerned in our previous years because we still had a number of vacancies within our executive structure. But we have filled all that. We also want to acknowledge that we have had a bit of a high staff turnover over the past year. Partly it was at executive level. As honorable members are aware that we had a few dismissals due to non-performance, but we also had deaths within the organization. And I think one of the things that my executive in corporate services will do will just to disintegrate those figures so that we can be able to be clear within that turnover, what is death, what has been dismissals, and what did we actually do. So I think within this financial year, we were above the market rate in terms of staff turnover. We have also targeted some HRD projects to really enhance our management capacity, particularly within the region. The outcome-based reporting and monitoring tools, I have spoken to that, and that is the dashboard that I'm referring to. But what also we have enhanced is, instead of saying we'll just put 704 classrooms, we ask the questions and so on. What is the difference that those classrooms have made within those communities? So we're stretching our target beyond the output into the outcome. We're also trying to address the root causes of queries and matters of emphasis that have been raised by the 2005-06 audit period, and the audit report expressed an unqualified opinion without any matters of emphasis. I think I should give a bit of background in as far as this point is concerned. Honorable members are aware that in 2003-2004, that was the first financial year in which the Auditor General started auditing programs within the IDT. If you are aware that departments do transfer money into the IDT for the implementation of the social infrastructure. And throughout the previous years, it was only the capital base of the IDT that was being audited. So the auditing started in the period of 2003-2004. That then meant that we need to be reconciling all the previous years' transfers from departments. It created a very huge backlog in as far as our financial management systems are concerned. And this is a backlog that we have been working on since 2003-2004. So some of the matters of emphasis, some of the matters that has been raised by the Auditor General relate to those backlogs. For instance, the issue of reconciliation. We had to reconcile almost all our clients' reports. But my CFO will be giving more detail on that should members be interested. But I think it's also important to say that there were quite a number of other new things that the AG introduced, like for instance the discounting, which was a requirement that was not previously given to us. And we had to do almost all that within a very short space of time. I will be quick to acknowledge that partly the project that we have right now within our finance department is actually to clean up almost all the issues that have been raised by the Auditor General. And our approach is not just to respond to what has been raised, but to look into the root causes of some of the issues that were highlighted. We have spent in this financial year about 97% of our operational budget, which we think, again, is within the threshold of 5% under or over expenditure. And we have effectively influenced and managed the DFI review. The DFI review is this project of Treasury that has been looking into the reviewing of parastata. The structure and the business practice. In terms of structure, our operational model combines centralized systems, process, policies and functions with decentralized operations which informs the structure. This refers to the fact that we do have our head office, but we also have presence in almost all the 9 provinces. So we do have a centralized and a decentralized type of structure. Innovation, operations and challenges of the 4 business units. And these are the 4 business units. This is the Development Program Services, and that is the unit that is headed by Mr. Wakama. Corporate Services, Pinky heads that. Financial Services, the CFO heads that. And Office of the CEO, Professor Edith Fries, heads that. Unfortunately, she is out of the country at the moment, and she could not come with us. In terms of human resources management report, you will see that in the appendix, which clearly articulates how our human resource management has been proceeded. The annual financial statement is also covered on pages 65 to 70. I'm not going to repeat that, which is really the opinion of the Auditor General, which gave us an unqualified audit opinion. And I think for the first time in the 5 years, we actually have no matters of emphasis. So yes, we still have a number of issues in terms of housekeeping matters and in terms of some of the issues that have been raised in the report. But in as far as matters of emphasis, this is the first time in the 5 unqualified audits that we have had no matters of emphasis. In terms of performance information, I think I have spoken to that to some detail, that there has been a shift from output to outcome. We are emphasizing more the outcomes of our interventions rather than the output. And that also has been measured by the AG. Maybe I should also say that it was the first time this year that the AG also did a bit of performance auditing. And that took some samples from some of the regions. They have not covered all the regions, but they did sample on some of the regions. And it looks like this is going to be the trend now. There's going to be financial auditing, but also extensive performance auditing. I must say the process of our auditing was quite robust. As you can see from the AG's overall report countrywide, that it has been quite extensive. There were a lot of things that were introduced during the year, and there were quite a number of things that were expected from us as well. We, in terms of the performance information, we've also adopted a balanced scorecard. And we thought that if the balanced scorecard first and foremost it contributes into the performance management by oversight bodies like yourself, but it also assists internally within the organization in terms of the evaluation of individual performance of the executive head and as well as the units themselves. So we're quite happy with the scorecard that we have developed, and we hope as we report in the next financial year we'll be giving you results of whether it has worked or not. This is the first year in which we're implementing a scorecard within the organization. In terms of material losses and contingent liability, we're saying that there are several legal actions that were reported within the IDT, and we are defending most of these matters. We think we will be able to put through. Actually, most of them, I think we have closed them. Just to give honorable members an example of some of the matters that we deal with. Quite often, our business model is that we implement our programs through third parties. So the IDT does not have a contingent of engineers, but the IDT contracts engineers on behalf of the department. Now, quite often what happens is that if the department renegates on its agreement in one way or the other, the liability falls within the IDT. Right now, we are dealing with a case in the Northwest Province whereby we appointed engineers, they did the drawings. The drawings were fine. They were submitted back to the department, but the department decided, no, we're withdrawing this particular project from the IDT. The person that drew the plan wants his money, so he took us to the public protector. So we're dealing with that because the contractual agreement is between us and the service provider. So those are some of the risk areas in as far as our service delivery model is concerned. The other would be that we had come across was between the gazetted figures for engineers and the IDT figures. Initially, we were using our own negotiated rates, but our own negotiated rates are lower than the gazetted rates. So most of the service providers then challenged us on that. And of course, because those rates are gazetted, we have to revert back to those. So those are the type of litigations that we've been dealing with. But most of them we have been able to challenge and resolve. We're saying given the multiple operational agreements and the volume of transactions the organization enters into to deliver its core business, legal disputes are inevitable. If you look into the billion rand that we spend and the number of contracts, I'm not sure whether we have a collation of the number of contracts my colleagues could assist, and the transactions that we do on a daily basis, how much do we pay for on a daily basis? 54,000 transactions a year. That are the transactions that goes through our system. So we're saying, given that magnitude, just the volume, legal litigation are inevitable. But we are happy that our litigation have not been as enormous as one would have expected. In terms of concluding remarks, honourable members. Challenges and opportunities. I think we would be the first to say that our environment is not without challenges. You would agree with me, honorable members, that our portfolio or our mandate is quite a very complex portfolio, because while what should be measured in terms of the actual delivery, there is also the poverty element that is core to the mandate of the IDT. So continuously we need to be balancing that as we go along. So we do express our appreciation for the committee's interest in the long-term financial sustainability of the IDT and for supporting the DFI review. And I think, Madam Chair, if time does allow, would be to invite us that when we come for the special project, we also include the DFI review, that report on the DFI that was done by the consultants, so that we can interact much more at content level in terms of what did the consultant find the IDT to be. But I think it is very pleasing that was an independent evaluation of our project, of our work, which which its outcome was the IDT is relevant in terms of its mandate. It has actually implemented according to its mandate. But we would definitely make time to come and discuss that with yourself. As I have said, all our executive posts have been filled, and 80% of our senior management posts have also been filled. I think I must also say that in terms of skills, we have been losing a few of our experts, particularly with the construction boom, project managers in particular. The big companies have been taking a lot of our project managers. Some of them have even gone abroad. So they've actually been losing them also to go internationally. We have concluded a critical skills profile, and we're finalizing revisions to our remuneration policy in order to retain skills and for our operations. What we have then decided to do was to come up with a different process for skills so that we can be able to be market related. That means we will pitch our skills at the market rate, more like the private sector pays, so that we can be able to retain more of that. Although the progress is slow, we are participating in the conceptual work around the anti-poverty strategy, which we expect will signal a fundamental shift in the approach to poverty eradication. For us, we think this is a breakthrough. For this country to pause and to say we do need an anti-poverty reduction strategy, something that is consolidated, one document that all of us can read and measure the same way. And we think it is a breakthrough. If we can be able to conclude this piece of work, we think it will make a very big difference in as far as the achievement of the Millennium Development Goals. The MAS schools, together with the Department of Public Works, will put a bid to Treasury of about 2 billion rand. The honorable members are aware that we did report to yourself that we are implementing or we are trying to eradicate the MAS schools, but the IDT from its coffers only provided about 150 million rand for this financial year towards that. That is just a gap. When we then coordinated together with the Department of Public Works and the Department of Education, the extent of the backlog was coming to plus minus 2 billion rand. We'll put that bid to Treasury, and we are awaiting the response to Treasury. But we feel that although we can put in the 150 million, it's not going to really make a major dent. Most of the budgets of the Department of Education at the moment is focusing on new schools, is focusing on children under the tree. But the structure of mass schools and schools that are not in good condition, there is no budget that has been put to that. So what we have been pushing has been to provide a budget towards that. We're also happy that that particular program is one of the priorities, the presidential priorities. So it is within the program of action. Would also request that the committee do indicate to us what other information is required to be comfortable with presenting reports to Parliament. We endeavor to improve all the time in providing information to the Portfolio Committee, and would welcome other ways of providing that information so that we make your work easier as well. We also invite the committee to attend our public accounting launch of the 2006-2007 annual report at Labisa Hospital on the 8th of November. What we do is that we account to the public, we account to the constituencies that we serve, and we do that in our various projects. For instance, we are going to Labisa Hospital. Labisa Hospital is one of the biggest hospitals that we have constructed using local labor. We have plowed all the money that refers to that to the local communities within that. We also bring other project members from throughout the country to come and share some of those experiences. So for us, it's an accounting process to our beneficiaries. And we would invite honorable members that you could come and be with us as we account to the public. We also feel that it will also give you an opportunity to see an IDT-driven project, one of our successful projects. We'll also want to take you to the projects that have not been successful, so that you can also be able to see what are the challenges that we face on the ground, and what is it that contributes to some of the projects that we implement not being successful. Thank you, Honorable Member.
Thank you very much. Do we still have people who are going to make presentations, or should we start to end? Okay. You may continue.
Thank you, Chair. Honorable members, I think it's just to add and provide some details on some of the areas of the presentation of the CEO. I think the area I want to emphasize is around social infrastructure facilitation. In the previous year, the portfolio, as we referred to as such, of the IDT was around 650 million. In the current financial year that we're reporting on, it grew to about 1.2 billion. And that had serious implications in terms of how the organization built its own capacity to deliver in terms of that growth. I also want to indicate that if the members have the actual annual report, statistics I wanted to take them through on the report. I'm not sure whether besides the presentation, whether they...
We do have.
We do have the copy.
Okay. Let me just check
on our members. Do you all have copies? You know, the stars always send us every time this is due. My story is, I know you were not around, so you will get a copy. Yes,
great. I'm sorry to refer them to page 43 of the report. On page 43, there are some specific key performance indicators that I think are of relevance to the members. I think in the middle of page 43, we've outlined some assumptions, scientific informed assumptions, which we've used in order to interpret that which we do in the form of an impact to the communities that we work with. We also got access to basic services, and I think those statistics were captured in the presentation by the CEO. In terms of employment creation, we've indicated there the number of jobs that we've created through the initiatives that we've implemented through the year. Human development, we've indicated the number of people trained in the various skills. Institutional development, we've indicated the capacity initiatives we're engaging and then the effect, provision of food security, environmental conservation, local economic development. I think the statistics are there, Chairperson. I just wanted to raise them for the attention of the members. On page 45, we have outlined there a schedule of our portfolio, totaling 1.275 billion. We've also outlined the spending of 1.1 billion and then the fact that close to 50% of that, 414 million, was spent on PTI. At the bottom of that same page, much of the report that was made by the CEO in terms of our ASCISA intervention on the right, bottom corner there has been outlined. Proceeding to the second page of the report. I believe, Chair, that these statistics will assist in closing or in completing the high-level presentation that the Chief undertook. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, but these are the same figures of last year. There's no change in last year of page 31. The same figures. Exactly.
You're looking where, sir?
The last year's report.
Uh-huh.
The features that the assumptions that you've gone through is the same as last year.
Yeah, the assumptions. The assumptions are not the development indicators. The assumptions are that if we build a school, it will benefit 40 kids, and therefore we...
Yes, I'm saying they are the same assumptions.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah,
like that.
Yeah,
they are the same assumptions. In a new financial year, they're the same.
Yeah.
So I thought maybe you're presenting something new.
No, and I think what is new, Chair, is the development figures beneath those assumptions. I was just bridging the introduction of those outputs. If you look at page 43, we've got access to basic services, we're indicating classrooms, we're indicating jobs created, we're indicating human development, etc., etc. And some of those figures have been worked out using those assumptions.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Let me thank the CEO for the presentation. Before honorable members started a discussion, I think first we need to appreciate as Parliament the fact that government's objective this is not about the measurable output that they put in place, but is to look at the impact of those outputs on a day-to-day life of society. I think to me that's the most important element, and we appreciate that we look at the quality of life. Vis-a-vis just giving us numbers, I think that's appreciated. And IDT has also initiated a step in that direction. Two, I also appreciate the fact that the performance audit that's made by the AG actually put the scale higher. So the bar is raised higher and higher for government, and that will improve performance, especially for a government that only has existed, a democratic state that only existed only in 13 years. I think I'm worried about Tunisia and Chile, that we're going to contest, not necessarily for competition's sake, but to show that we will meet the MDGs. I think that's one of the strategies of this government, to give an improved service to our people. I think that's appreciated. Also, appreciate the fact that you did not get a qualification looking at other institutions and organizations. For instance, I know the construction sector had a disclaimer. So, you are far way better than people who take a disclaimer, who actually is supposed to implement, an implementing organization like yourself, but they had a disclaimer and you did not have a single emphasis of matter from the HR side. But there are issues of processes that we acknowledge that we need to look into, especially when it relates to issues of control, especially at regional levels where special projects are implemented. I think it's an ongoing matter that we deal with. We also would want to see us having clear targets, measurable targets that we will deal with on a regular basis, which is something that we need. And I do understand why there's what you term the tweaking, which I will say is an adjustment to the key strategic objectives, given that there's new management. Of course, there will be a different regime, but that's allowed in terms of government principles. It's allowed because it did not change what we want to achieve as outcomes. So there's a thin line, in actual fact, from changing those key strategic objectives from being fixed. For actually, I was interested in the one that specify on tech economic environment. I tried to look at it. Basically, you are more focused in terms of what you want to achieve. That's also appreciated. I think those are the few issues that we will, but I will make my comments later in terms of the report. First, I want to get an indication from honorable members who want to engage on the report itself. Honorable Opperman, Honorable Blanche, and Honorable Kupido, and Honorable Emma Duma, and Honorable Nyawani, in that order, please.
Thank you, Chair. I would like to thank the CEO for the clear vision of IDT, the plans you have to implement what you want, and for the emphasis that you have, not only on inputs, but also on outcomes. We will appreciate the report from Tunisia and Chile. Maybe you can give us an indication on where we are as a country on achieving that MDG. What is frustrating and how we can get to that point where we will reach our goals. You also referred to deepening the intervention in project consolidate municipalities. And you refer to 10 municipalities that you are involved in. What is the criteria that you use to determine those 10 municipalities? Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you. Honorable Blanchard.
Sorry, Chair, that machine is out of. There you are. On page 43 of your report, you are referring, you've referred us to the average number of learners and so on. And then you the figures you are giving us, average number of persons per dumping site and average wage rate per person per day, 50 rand. Now, I think 50 rand per day was the Labor Department's rate probably 10 years ago. They are now requiring a minimum rate of at least 100 rand a day, I believe, which is for domestic workers or any type of workers any person should employ. If you are using 50 rand a day, then you are creating a calculated figure of number of people employed, double the size that it should be, and then we are distorting the number of jobs that we seem to be creating. Why did you use 50 rand a day? Why not use what is actually the figure that the Department of Labor wants you to use that should be paid to people?
Thank you. Honorable Speaker.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think one of the challenges that was mentioned by the CEO is probably the skills problem. And I think that's a nightmare for anybody who is in the construction business at this stage. I remember visiting an oversight visit to Kimberley, where there were two sites quite close to one another. And those people were actually like almost stealing one another's skills, especially the care skills. So I would like to know, in your revision of the remuneration, if you could give us an indication of what the difference in budget will eventually be, if we should go market-related salaries, and if there's any other kind of incentives that intend using to keep those skills within the IEC. Thank you.
Thank you. Honorable Matuba.
Thank you, Chairperson. I would like to add a voice on the question of the presentation, but it was a very comprehensive presentation. I think we really appreciate that. But having said that, I think there are a few questions that I would like to ask. Perhaps before that, one needs to make at least a comment or commend the IDT on their swift response in conscience work. I think that's one critical element as a member of parliament in terms of at least the conscience work that we're doing, because we're deploying various consciences. And if we see certain problems, your kind of a swift response, it assists us in terms of also realizing the impact of the government at that level. Since I interacted with them in the Eastern Cape, and then they sent their foot soldiers. I got the feedback, but over and above that, when I went back, I visited the school. It's a school that was sent around office block, and then the learners were not having classes, just learning and really in a very appalling situation, putting books on the cement, and the learners were sitting on the cement. They were not just. And then when I visited the school, the principal was very much impressed about the fact that at least there were about 32 desks that were delivered through the intervention of the IDT. At least we commend them for that. But I think that there is still relevant work that needs to be done in terms of interacting with the Department of Education in this same case, ensuring that at least the office block itself is really put in the right conditions. I think that's at least a work in progress in that regard. But we need to commend them on the work if they we happen to know some of the concerns work that they've done. Then, Chairperson, there is a comment, there's a question around the monitoring tools as to whether perhaps given this system, which also has got to be linked with the actual project, as to whether perhaps in terms of the capacity of the IDT, they do have at least people at their regional offices who are assisting them in terms of at least giving them a feedback in terms of the actual project itself, other than it is pressing a button and you say that the project is another second basis, but you need to know also the quality of the work that has been done. As well as perhaps in terms of the capacity of the IT guy able to respond to smart studies. Chair, they speak about the fact that they do not have employed technical people like the engineers. The work they do to the council, they sort of contract engineers to be the consultants. The question, therefore, would be that to what extent are they able to monitor those engineers? Because if they become consulted, more from their point of view would be that of having at least a contract about 3 or 4 that they are involved in. As a result of that, you find that this consultant is sitting about 50 kilometers away from those projects, and there's no proper monitoring, and you are sitting up there at head office. We have come across some of the challenges in KZN, for instance, where just a consultant is virtually not there next to the project, but you find that he remains a consultant and is getting money, and therefore this question of monitoring does also talk to that as well. Also, sir, we have visited the Northern Cape, I think last month, I can't recall whether about 2 months ago, something like that. But we visited Kuruman District Municipality. When we interacted there with the District Municipality, they did not know. In fact, they do not have any presence of the IGT. We asked them about the presence of IGT. They do not have presence. There is quite a number of things that are quite negative. And if you are saying that the ladies now, you have got now direct contact with the municipalities, to what extent, therefore, are you able also to correct those perceptions from those municipalities that are not eager to cooperate with yourselves? Thank you. For whatever reasons, I'm not linking the any size, but there is something that needs to be done in terms of those challenges.
Thank you, Honorable
Thank you. Thank you, Chairperson. Maybe I think I need to echo the what other members have just said about the presentation. This is really what you would like to hear. My first question is about the EPWP tracking of beneficiaries. Actually, my question is based around the coordination of activities. Since you've got projects from IDT, how close do you work with the CIDB as part of public works entity? And at the same time, you made mention of the engineers that are contracted out, and we have CDE that is working and that have got these engineers and how closely do you work with CDE and CIDB in promoting the upcoming contractors? The other question is around the long-term financial sustainability, especially that you are focusing on rural areas and municipalities that really don't have enough funding. So what are your future plans? Do you plan to operate on full cost recovery from the department, like maybe if you are building a school or the Department of Education should assist you one way or the other? And maybe you could share with us the as part of the challenges, now that you are accounting directly to the public, what challenges do you meet on the ground there with the COVID? Because we have seen it's
really very difficult when you have to organize people around certain projects. Yeah.
Thank you, Comrade Shepherdson. Comrade Shepherdson, I would like to congratulate the CEO for really an intense and annual report that she tabled to us this morning, and perhaps would like to comment on some of the issues she has raised. You know, the main legislative mandate of IDT, as determined by government, they, at this point in time, they are, you know, the machinery of government to assist in halving unemployment by 2014. I think they fit into that program as we speak. And perhaps to be able to do that, where I am sitting, I know there's lots of unemployment in the rural area, in the urban areas, but there's enormous unemployment and poverty in the rural areas. Hence, people at the night come to the city with the hope of finding jobs, which at the end they don't. And a number of these people are not interested in coming into the city, but the opportunity are almost non-existing in the rural area. I see IDT, you know, as an agency that is very much effective in the very rural areas we're talking about, so that you begin to develop these areas and empower those people where they are. Is there a thinking in the IDT to be more focused in the rural areas where mainly women who would not want to leave their homes and come to the city, but would like to be able to feed their children and work where they are. Perhaps in relooking at IDT's role, are they thinking in that mind of actually focusing their resources and energies and expertise in the rural area, rather than perhaps looking, rather than being very much broad? The second issue I want to raise is the issue raised by Comrade Maduma on the monitoring tool. I think that touches as well on our own department, Department of Public Works. You see, it looks like we government, we put guidelines and rules, and thereafter we do not put tools to monitor that. You go where government has given huge tenders to these companies. When you go there, it seems we do not put terms as government to those big companies like Murray and Roberts, making sure that they implement the EPWP guidelines. When they get there, it seems it is those big companies that set terms for us, which means as government we are failing. We are saying something here and doing something different. You get a situation where when you meet some of these consultants, they tell you, no, this is high tech, you can't have EPWP here, we can't have people who are disabled here, you know. They are now the ones who are dictating. You know, that puts a challenge to us as government, because people are saying, we go over on radios, we go on TVs, talking about EPWP, but when you go there, that the very EPWP guidelines is not actually being implemented. And this is where, this is an area where we begin to reduce the unemployment we're talking about, which means then we are actually not doing what we're supposed to be doing. IDT gets involved in the construction. Maybe it happened with Kavisa, it happened with other, but directly now to the Department of Public Works, how do we monitor that each and every project we are supposed to be actually, you know, giving? I mean, if anyone gets a tender from government, they must know that this is what is expected of that company. If they are not going to do that, we've got the power, so we've got to use the systems we sort of
you know, leave everything, I mean, over, I mean, to them to, I mean, to do that. The issue of mass schools, you reported that you were not, you are unsure how funds will be allocated. To us, that is very important, you know, because, I mean, we are very much interested as this committee on the progress of the mass schools and perhaps where the concentration will be. And from time to time as a committee, we really want to go and visit those mass schools and see progress, I mean, being made, you know, around that, because we get a hype of launch of these projects and then perhaps we don't hear anything about them later. We don't want to see at the tail end that these did not actually go on as planned, but as the project is moving, we want to be part of that. Same applies to the issue of jobs for growth. You know, the deputy president of the country speaks so eloquently about that project, but it should not only be about speaking, it should be about the implementation of that, and as a committee, we want to see that she's so articulate and so good about it, but are you as officials doing what she's telling the world about the job for growth? That's very important to us. Thank you.
Thank you. May we entertain responses, please?
Chairperson, thank you. The first question raised was the criteria used to select, for example, the 10 indicated municipalities that we've worked on. We've used the ISRDP, Integrated Sustainable Rural Development Program notes, you know, identified. I think that's where we focus much of our intervention with local government. I think there's a consensus that there's most need in those, in terms of the process pursued by government. The second question was, why a rate of 50 rand per day, whereas this rate has changed, I think, a few years ago. This rate is a negotiated, expanded public works rate. I think it's a rate specifically targeted at expanding volumes. So you're right in terms of your thinking. Obviously, the downside is exactly what you say, that it may seem that there's more people employed, but the upside is that the small cake becomes shared amongst many than the few. So it is a negotiated rate within the confines of that program.
Can I just maybe add on that to say, also what it takes into consideration is that within the EPWP implementation, there's training that's compulsory. Now, when you try to balance the actual implementation, the pace, and the time that must be taken off, ultimately it means practically you're saying the contractor must subsidize that, because the contractor will only be able to claim once they've finished a certain portion of implementation. Now, the negotiations between NEDLAC in terms of the implementation of the EPWP and the principles that are within the EPWP, whereby issues of training is actually compulsory. So it means within an 8-day work or whatever number of, there might be 2 hours that is taken off that. How do you begin to, from an economic point of view, encourage the contractor to really implement the EPWP? There was then a need to go and negotiate a special rate for the EPWP that you can be able to achieve the other objectives of the EPWP, which is the skills development, the learnership, and the increasing of employability for those people that are participating.
If that is the case, and one looks at what you are saying to us as far as your high staff turnover in some of these areas is concerned, it sounds to me that we're paying the IDT staff a high salary, we're paying the worker who gets the job, the Expanded Public Works Program job, a low salary, and it takes some time to get it. And thereafter, you've got no skills because you've left the skill gap. Are we achieving anything if we carry on like this?
I'm not sure whether I fail to understand the question, but maybe just to explain the one area. The rate of 50 rands is the labor rate that the contractors pay for the engaged labor under the auspices of the EPWP program. So this is the rate that we pay laborers. This is the rate that was negotiated, taking into account the fact that much of the investment on the people is training over and above the need to spread the slice. I'm not sure I got the question and the link between that rate and the IDT.
I'll try to interpret what he said, if I understood him correctly. He said that if you're negotiating a payment with a contractor to pay a worker 50 rand, the flip side of it is not justification that contractor employs more people, if that's what you're saying, Honorable Member. But then what we will need to discuss, perhaps, will be, does this contractor adhere to what Honorable Ramosamai was talking about, that in terms of our BEE policies and the EPWP guidelines, do they adhere to the matter? Because if the intention is to create more jobs, have we measured that? I think that's what we need to discuss. And perhaps we won't be able to get an answer today, but we'll have to look at when we evaluate projects, because that's what we will need to oversee as members of parliament, to check, to do the quality check, and to check whether people have employed more. So there will be no need for us to deal with that, but we'll note it when we do our oversight visits to projects. We'll take a test base, because basically the issue is when we scale what we're paying in terms of salaries to our staff members, I think that's what the honorable member has evaluated. Does it speak to the outcomes we want to achieve at the end? It might not necessarily speak to your salaries making impact, but does the contract work we receive impacts on that? I think that's what we'll deal with it. If the honorable member agrees, thank you very much. May we continue?
Thank you, Chair. The next question raised was the effectiveness of the monitoring tool. I think monitoring is generally an issue in the country. I think the honourable member indicated the good intentions and the initiatives that government pursues, and the fact that often we fail in this regard. I think in particular in the financial year that we're reporting on, I think it's captured also in the report. We're very proud to report that we have instituted a very, very effective system. We call it Kitimang. It's not the personalized name, we call it within the organization. But it's a robust program management system. I think Kitimang means Kitimang, Obaleka in Kosa. It's a robust program management system which has got as part of its module the monitoring information. It empowers us. It's got a facility we call a dashboard, which assists us to evaluate the progress in projects themselves, as well as report on quality issues and concern on projects. But again, monitoring evaluation is equally a human capacity or a human intervention method, equally as a tool. In other words, if our people fail to effectively manage and ensure that the quality at the delivery point, we will have problems. And again, we've ensured that we're okay in this regard. We've boosted up our capacity in terms of quality assurance engineers at region, to ensure that as we deploy the infrastructure, we've got people who work after those processes to ensure that quality is done. There has been a time lag in this regard. We had a portfolio in terms of infrastructure program that was around 650 million. That grew to about 1.5 million. And therefore, we're working to close that time lag, also in capacity to undertake such things as these. So yes, we covered, but we do have a term lag that we're chasing as management. The other question raised was, do we have adequate capacity to effectively monitor and then manage the consultants engaged? Yes, we do. We pride ourselves as being leading in social infrastructure management programs, more so in doing it within a development context. And then therefore, much of our capacity is program management. Therefore, we can come confidently say, yes, we effectively manage them. Whether effectively means there are no issues, that's a different issue. The chief indicated that much of our talent relates to securing adequate skills in program management. I think it's a problem in the country generally.
And if we recruit more program managers for IDP.
And therefore, we're not satisfied with the level of the capacity we have. We still want more capacity to make sure that we do that job better. The next question was, why is the IDT not fully represented in the Northern Cape? The IDT's representation in provinces is a product, I would say, of two major processes. One is the proactive move from the IDT in terms of identification of the areas of need in those provinces and working to provide those support services. The other is a realization of the need for support from the province itself. We are in the Northern Cape, but I think the comment is very accurate. Our representation is not as much as we would want. Part of the response that we receive in some of the initiatives that we launch is that the province in terms of size, not geographically, it's very big geographically, in terms of size, budget, numbers, is very small, and that it's relatively empowered to drive some of its initiatives, to deployment of its own capacity. And therefore, the need is relatively lower than some of the other provinces. Also, in terms of the identification of the nodes, for example, from the ISRDP program, I think there's very few municipalities, if any, on the north. I think there's one in that area identified on the north. So that would affect how our representation seems to be at the present moment. The next question, Chair, was whether our work or whether we have links with the CIDB and with the CBE. Yes, we do. We have, for example, recently developed an emerging contractor development strategy. Critical in the success of this strategy is the participation of both these institutions, because they are very relevant to what we do. But more so, we belong to the same family, and therefore, that also assists in terms of ensuring that there's a cooperation between us. There are other platforms where we sit with these structures under the auspices of the department. So yes, we work with those. There's always a room for better coordination. Often we tend as institutions to be focused on our mandate and then talk less. So it's something we are aware about, that we should always strive to do better in that regard. The next question was the question about long-term sustainability. Do we plan to operate on full cost recovery? This matter is a matter at hand. I think the DFI review process partly would respond to this matter. We ourselves are undertaking an internal process which we call a cost recovery model. The question that needs to be answered is, where should the IDT operations be funded? should they be funded out of the services that the IDT provides? Should they be funded out of the national fiscal? And I think these processes will begin to respond to this question. We've also initiated a business case for ourselves, which we're working with Treasury as well as the Department. And we believe that once we've concluded this process, we'll be able to provide a specific answer to that question. Currently, our funding comes from the interest, from the endowment that we received from government 8 years ago. And a portion of it comes from a minimal recovery we make from the department, which is not adequate to cover the entire operational cost. But we've got processes ready to respond to that question adequately. The other question raised was, should we not focus on rural development, given that you know that's where the need is the most? In fact, that policy shift has been taken by the IDT. I think the policy shift is that we must focus on women and rural development. The DFI review has reinforced that view. It has asked questions whether, because if you look at our program, you would note that there's a significant component of it that is in the Gauteng province. And the DFI review team was asking, should we not rather focus on building a portfolio elsewhere rather than Gauteng, given that Gauteng possibly does not need us as much as other regions do? Yes, that policy decision has been taken, and the direction we're moving to. It's not an exclusivity kind of an approach, so we will continue to work in Gauteng and in other areas, but the focus will indeed be on the most needy areas. The other question here was, how does the IDT monitor consultants to ensure attainment of empowerment objectives, including the EPWP objectives? Chair, we've got the BIMS, the Beneficiary Information Management System, which we developed and share with the department, which is targeted at managing information on empowerment and on tracking through the chain, where from enter to exit, what happens to the beneficiaries that we engage. We also, if you noted on the report, there's a figure of, I think it's about 48,000 jobs, 48,700 on page 43, which we've indicated, of the jobs that have been created. We extract this figure from our report system, which we institute for all the consultants that we use. So yes, we manage this area. It's an area fraught with challenges. Part of the challenges come from the client departments themselves, where there's disjuncture in terms of what they want. They want development, but they want projects delivered yesterday. And this is an ongoing challenge. Depending on which forum and what is the agenda on the table, if the agenda on the table is that the department has to spend and deliver within the financial year end, the other thing tends to be forgotten about, and spending becomes crucial. But also the contractors themselves are not always willing to engage in this expanded methodology, which we should ensure more employment. They want it to have it easy and fast. But we are working on that. The other question here was funding allocation on the math schools. IDT has provided a seed funding of 150 million out of its own endowment in this program. That 150 million is shared among 8 provinces, excluding Gauteng, in amounts of between 5 million and 35 million, depending on the need. In this region, for example, Western Cape region, where the need is not as in Limpopo or KZN or Eastern Cape, we would give 5 million and maybe in KZN there would be 35 million allocated. But again, this is a seed funding. Seed funding which should be augmented by the 2 billion allocation by National Treasury. That 2 billion, we've been advised that in principle it will be availed. The processes are still continuing. In terms of the allocation into provinces, we've not reached that stage. We are also undertaking a needs analysis, a national needs analysis, which should also cost, it must audit the backlog, it must cost the backlog and advise on the methodology to eradicate the backlog. We do not intend to reinvent the wheel. Some of these audits have been undertaken by the department but have not been reconciled over time. And therefore you find a list in the national government which does not reconcile on the list in provincial government, because if the list had, for argument's sake, 100 schools, 13 of those have since been built or, you know, or revamped. But that information has not come back to the national list. So there's an exercise of cleaning and reconciliation that must be done. We are in the process of trying that process. Chair, I think my colleagues would respond to the remaining questions and may also add to some where there's more information.
Thanks, Chair. I think I'll just add on one or two which touch on my area. The question which was asked by the Honourable Member on scarcity of skills and how we are aiming to retain skills. There are quite a number of interventions that we're presently engaging in. We've got a phase that we've gone through, we've finished phase one in terms of the remuneration policy review. We're now in phase two where we're looking in terms of the scarcity of retention, but also we've also started implementing some of the recommendations that have come out of the first phase. Firstly, maybe just to bring to the attention of the members that we are paying our scarce skills at median plus 10%, which has been approved in terms of our remuneration. So we're looking, we're not paying lower than the salary range of 50th percentile. So we're looking at 50th percentile plus 10%. But above that, we're also saying we need to introduce a premium salary that we to just to try and retain the scarce skill, and we're looking at how do we introduce a premium salary and what percentages we'll be looking at given the variety and the options in terms of skills strategies. So we haven't implemented that part of it. But also we've actually introduced benefits that contract, because normally project managers will be your contract people. We employ them on contract basis. So we're saying that they must enjoy the benefits of permanent staff that we have, like your performance management system, your other benefits in terms of medical aid, in terms of your providence, all the things that might not be part of the contract, we're extending that to them. We're still busy calculating the cost of that. We can't give you the cost offhand. So once it's done, that we'll be able to provide you with the cost. In terms of the monitoring aspect, the monitoring, I just thought that we need to actually inform you that there is a contract management system that we have introduced to support the dashboard system, to say as we implement contracts, do we have red flags that are going to tell us, give us, you know, sort of a sign in advance to say, are we delivering on these milestones? So that also legally, our legal unit will then say, are there legal aspects that we need to take care of before the contract expires? So there's an automation system that we're using alongside the dashboard that will support us in terms of that. And then on the one, also in terms of monitoring on the vendor management system, we've got also in terms of service providers that we're going to be actually monitoring them on dashboard again to say, these are our service providers, how do we then treat them throughout the value chain? So we're supporting the core business in terms of that. So those are the two interventions that I would say in terms of monitoring that we're busy, you know, finalizing automation processes that will support the program. Thanks, Chair.
Yeah, but can we first check whether all the responses are as well, then we can take some. Just see that the CEO, you want to speak to that.
No, thank you, Chair. I just want to talk about very briefly on the DFI review. I sit in the DFI review as a public works representative in the steering committee. obviously driven by national treasurers, but they have confirmed or at least shared with us, or rather we have agreed that the report should be tabled or should be submitted to cabinet, you know, at least by December, and the aim is to, or whenever the last cabinet meeting, but by January should be serving before the cabinet liquidation, because it's been going on for quite a while. But the whole issue about the DFI review, I think, simply put, we are looking at whether these DFIs are serving the needs of this developmental state. So we're looking at a whole list of the DFIs, the DPSAs, the IDCs, coolers, and all of that. But I think Tendi will probably talk to you about the business case of the IDC, obviously, being entertained as we speak, to actually look at how the IDC is going to be like going forward. Thank you very much, Chair.
On the issue of mass schools, fortunately, we've got a clip on the Dalisoga, which honourable members had identified as a priority of the mass schools. I think every year in January, in the newspapers, you see the shame of schools in South Africa. So I think next year you'll see something different. We launched this project end of June. Was it June, July? I think it was July, and this clip was taken in August, just to show the progress that has happened, and with the findings directly from the IDC. I thought we could just share that with honourable members. But just on a few other things, the practical implementation of Jobs for Growth. As I said, Chairperson, I would really appreciate an opportunity for us to come and give you detail of the Jobs for Growth. It's really exciting, honourable members. I think the latest agreement that we've had with SCORE, whereby SCORE is not going to bake the scones themselves, but our ladies will be baking the scones from the communities. And we are advanced in terms of that agreement. We've got all the list of SCORE shops throughout the country, and we are linking that with the projects that are there already on the ground. But one of the things that we realized was access to markets. We find that there are very good initiatives within communities, but because there's no access to markets, the ability of those socio economic interventions to interact with first economy is completely limited and not there. So one of the things that the Job for Growth is doing is actually to unblock that. We have got very good agreements with the Woolworths in terms of, if you live in KwaZulu-Natal, the Amadumbe, that we've always never taken very much, now it's a delicacy, and that is organic because it is grown really from in an indigenous way. We are linking those markets, because those are some of the resources that are within our people that we need to be able to unlock, so that we can be able to create a relationship between the second economy and the first economy. So I think there are a lot of exciting stories that we can share in as far as the practical implementation of Jobs for Growth. Yes, there are challenges, particularly challenges of funding, because once more, this is a special project that we are funding with the resources of the IDC. There hasn't been an allocation from the fiscal. We have put in a bid as well on that particular project, and we are waiting to hear whether our bid has been successful or not. I think I also wanted to just add on the monitoring tools, particularly on the EPWP principles. I must admit, honourable members, that it is a challenge. And one of the biggest challenges is the tension between the speed in delivery and the application of the EPWP principles. Particularly because the fact remains that most of the people that we want to attract into EPWP might not necessarily have the skills. So partly the coming in even before the implementation of the project and training those people so that they are ready to be absorbed into EPWP type of project becomes a bit of a process. So that tension is there. The conditions are there, but those conditions you find that we are unable to completely say you don't look into the PSMA, because PSMA, if you have not spent, it becomes a rollover. But if you say, I have not spent because I was still training EPWP participants, there is a contradiction. So I'm saying we shouldn't pretend as if that contradiction is not there. But as we implement, I think our EPWP program is improving. It is maturing. because we're identifying where the gaps are, and we are cleaning up those gaps as we work along. And I think one good thing is that we're working very closely with the department in as far as EPWP is concerned. But there was also an issue on the actual monitoring, the practical monitoring. I think we missed to say that it doesn't mean that the IDT does not have technical expertise, but we're saying we don't have the technical expertise that goes to do the implementation. What we do is the program management, the project management. So we have architects, we have engineers, both at head office and also at regional level. So our PIMs, what we refer to as our program implementing managers, are actually technical people. And that is where we are experiencing this loss. Those are the people that are being recruited somewhere else. So we do have a cadre of technical people that do the actual implementation. But sometimes you find that they are handling too many projects because we've lost a few people, and some of the projects must be consolidated to one. So those are some of the issues that we are cleaning up as we move along. There was also another element on accounting directly to the public. What challenges do we face? I think one of the biggest challenges that we face is that there's always need within communities. And you find that our intervention, because it is government, the department identifies you can build the school there, because according that is how the plan has happened. But you might find that there is a dire need for a clinic. The school is there, but there's no road. Children are drowning because they have to cross the river, because there's no bridge. And that budget of the bridge we don't have. By the time we solicit either from private sector or federal government to get that, it has taken some. Those are some of the challenges that we experience. But what we do with the accounting process is to enable communities to understand even the models in which we work. That we might not have a basket of budget for all that is required. One of the initiatives that our minister has done has actually to try and link the mass schools or the schools in the rural areas with the access roads budget. I think honorable members would remember that there was an access roads budget that was the Minister of Finance announced, which went to the Ministries of Transport. It was supposed specifically, it was a ring fence, it was a conditional grant, and one of the conditions was EPWP. But again, honorable members, we find that the configuration in provinces, some provinces, transport is not with public works. So that budget is with the Department of Transport. There is the Minister of Public Works responsible for the EPWP. Now, the alignment of that and making sure that the plans talk to each other, sometimes you find that it doesn't. So those are some of the challenges that when, as we do our accountability within communities, they raise these concrete requirements that we might not necessarily have the ability and the capacity to respond to. The issues of long-term financial sustainability and the full cost recovery. I don't think we are there in terms of full cost recovery, because if you look into the mandate of the IDT, I think my approach would be we mustn't lose this bond. We mustn't lose the actual mandate of the IDT to be a development agent of government. So the full cost recovery might not be the most ideal. But I think for us, these are some of the issues that we would like to discuss further with the honorable members. And you asked us how best to position the IDT, given also the information that you have as oversight. But we are looking into some cost recovery of some sort, but it might not be the full cost recovery in terms of our expenses. I think the issue of the scarce skills implications from a budgetary point of view, I don't think we have reached that level, honorable members, where we can say this would be the budgetary implication. But if that is required, I think it's a commitment that we can make. Because before we implement, we definitely need to know what would be the budgetary implication. So that is information that we can share with yourselves in terms of responding to that. The business model of the IDT, yes, we implement through third parties, but our biggest advantage is that we have got this contingent of technical skills within the IDT to manage, to monitor, to drive. So, and of course, our methodology as well enables us to achieve the issues that we have that we have put up. Chair, you are very right in terms of Chile, Tunisia, and my personal opinion, Chairperson, is that I actually think looking deep into, I was also part of a delegation that went to Chile and Tunisia, that we might actually have done more than they did. I think our biggest weakness as a country is that we report in a very fragmented way. If you recall that when we were putting our report for the MDG, it was reports that we took from various departments. First and foremost, because we don't have an anti-poverty strategy that we all read for. So we approach poverty at different levels. Everyone is approaching poverty, but at different levels. The measurements, we don't have standardized measurements. We're still using the MDGs measurements, which are international measurements. So our anti-poverty strategy and those measurements, which is the process that I have referred to, will enable us to measure from one. Their biggest advantage is that they have this anti-poverty strategy. They have the measurements. So they are able to say, this is where we were at this time, and we've moved to that, because they are measuring one thing. So I personally think, Chair, if you can, if I may say, is that I think we might have done more than they have done. If you look at our social security, the access into our social security, the backlog, I mean, really the extent in which we've been able to reduce some of the backlogs that we have in our communities, I think we have moved substantially. So I agree with you, Chair, to say if we were to compete relatively on the same scale, I personally feel we might have done more than that, but it is the way in which they have been reporting, the way in which they have been structured. When we went to cabinet, one of the questions that we put forward to cabinet was, are we well configured as a country to be able to implement an anti-poverty strategy, or to say, as a developmental state, we're responding to those issues? That's one of the questions that we pose to cabinet to say, as we move into the anti-poverty strategy, we also need to look into the issues of configuration. So I thought, Chair, I would close with that. But we will show you the clip if you have the time, Chair. It's 5 minutes, it's not long, it's just two. So you've done that? Yeah. Oh, you've done that. Oh, okay. Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Let's take a follow-up question, and then we break, just like a comfort break, 5 minutes, and then we continue. I saw the hand of Honorable Matuma and Honorable Opperman and Honorable Blanche.
Yeah, thank you, sir. Chair, my follow-up question will be around the question of this gas deal. I think one would like to know if whether in terms of driving transformational agenda as a country, our intervention also should try to respond to the challenge of the skewed kind of skepticism that are available in the country. That is, if you don't find by and large skills from the former disadvantage, people, you find it from the former advantage people, the so to speak, white people, who are by and large those consultants. And therefore, my question, I've looked at, for instance, page 47. They say that they've entered into a partnership agreement with Walter Sisulu University to support and participate in their annual rural development conference and undertaking joint research initiatives. Now, my question is that is whether they've not explored the possibility of engaging the institutions of higher learning in terms of also the graduates that are leaving those universities who could be absorbed by the IGT as a part of the transformational agenda. Precisely because, for instance, some of these universities, I mean, the graduates that are coming from these universities, if, for instance, I compete with a white person out there in the market, the first preference in this corporate world is a white person than myself. And that is still there. And now, my question is that if this perhaps is not ideal for us as a government, we have those kind of interventions that are also trying to redress those legacy in terms of absorbing some of those energy in our program, in terms, for instance, if the situation allows us, so that we are able also to respond to this question of poaching by this NASA corporate NASA world from yourself as IDT, because we'll be able also this return share strategy that you are able to absorb some of these graduates that are coming from these institutions. These are some of the challenges that the country in terms of graduate transfer shall attend and should look at it.
Actually, that question needs to be directed at the construction sector, because the Department of Labor is responsible for training of people. I don't know to which extent can we train people through the EPWP, which means immediate implementation. Well, the leadership programs are helping.
I'm referring to the graduates who have been trained, but they lack experience. That's where the challenge is. And if, for instance, you assign them with these established consultants within your establishment, they could be able to gain some experience during the course of the implementation of your program.
Well, I assume it's supposed to be part of the guideline in this case. But it's an EPWP issue. I think we will have to take issue with that at that point to check whether, in terms of capacitating people, do we make sure that we place the on-job placement, because that's part of the principles of our training. We supposed to have an on-job placement to make sure that people gain experience over time. I'm not sure. In terms of projects, I think it should be in a way. But let's take the second and the third question, and then we respond.
I'm somewhat clear about where we are with our own Millennium Development Goals. The question I was asking is, you said that the two countries, they have achieved their goals. It means halving their poverty. Where are we? Is it only a problem of configuration? Or can we get a clear indication of where we are at this moment in time and what we need to do to project our goals for 1940?
Thank you, Honorable Blanche.
I'm so worried about what happens with the grant that we give to organizations like the IDT. Because we must also look at the outcome of that amount of money that we get. And I would have rather appreciated seeing in the document, in the annual report, the amount of money that went into running the IDT and the amount of money that was paid out in jobs. Then I can balance, because for me, IDT is a consultant working for Parliament to create jobs out there. And I would like to see whether we are much paying this consultant far more than what we should have taken that money and handed it to a couple of farms and then created far more jobs, sustainable jobs. Because that's what we as members of the Parliament need to look at. What are the outcomes of the funding of the grants that we give to organizations to create jobs? And that now still worries me, because if I look at what happened here, as a member of parliament, I'm paid 500 times more than the person you've got on page 43. And it's no use us saying the Department of Labor is not involved yet, it's in the Senate Public Works Service. I want to whether it's still the transfer, I want to see whether a sustainable job was created with these grants that are in the future, and this year after year after year, are we seeing something that that's not good. I would like to throw an IDT to say to them, I'm not very happy with what I see, because we are not achieving sustainable jobs. And that's so worrying here, I think, as a commission we have to look at it.
Thank you. Let's entertain a response, but what I'm going to request after a tea break, just 5 minutes, comfort break, I'm going to request Ines, our researcher, to give us her own impressions about the report, because we requested her to prepare a research document which will further probe the issues that we would like to engage.
Executive posts have been filled, and there's from occupation to occupancy and regional office, but I start first. In other words, in your own case, you've got a problem with people in your employer or leaving you. You have not trained people for you, you're not trained your own part to stay with you.
And I think this matter was addressed, that the issue is poaching of skills. I think brain drain does not only happen to ICT, it happens to many government institutions. No, I'm saying it was responded to, that's what I'm trying to say, Honorable Member, that it was responded to, that it, even the retention strategy was to give a median plus 10% more, which needs to be tested whether, because what is what we're competing with is far more what we can afford. And that's one set of challenge that we as Parliament must make recommendations as to what do we think should be the strategy to try and assist not only ICT, but all government departments and institutions to be able to, whether we do it in the form of an agreement that at least you stay with us for 10 years or more, it's something that we need to discuss. But the challenge has been the salary levels that we pay our people need a review. So the work study will have to be taken to look at whether are we actually having clear guidelines to try and that's what I'm saying that was responded to, but we need to further deal with the matter ourselves, you know, I think, in my view. I think that if the Honourable Member allow me to summarize on the point in this matter. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair. I'm not going to be answering the questions, but just to share with you that the presidency is currently reviewing all these second economy programs. And maybe when the time comes, probably they'll table that report to Parliament. But also it may be useful that the presidency, the analysts there are called to Parliament to probably come and present the findings. And that would include, obviously, the current midterm review also of the EPWP. So all second economy interventions are being reviewed, and for one good reason, to assess their impact or the outcome of this program. I thought that let me share that with the government.
Yes. Honorable Chairperson, a few other questions that were raised, the transformation agenda and the skills. I think, Honorable Members, you are correct. The GIPSA program in particular was aimed at addressing that. But when you look, for instance, there was a comment on the CBE. You look into the registers in the CBE, the people that have been accredited, the people that you can then call professional. Between graduation at school and being a professional, there is a process of experiential learning. And quite often, the disadvantaged communities of South Africa do not have access to that experiential learning. It does also cost. People must be staying somewhere, they must travel, go to that work. And there are issues there. And GIPSA and the implementation that we're doing as IDT was to support these people to go through the experiential learning. And the minister has also started a process of even reviewing those standards. Well, some of the standards that are within the professional bodies themselves are actually standards that are not achievable. So on their own, they exclude. And one of the things that MINMEC has been discussing has been how do we begin to look into even those standards. So I think that there is a lot that's happening in that respect, but it is correct that is one of the challenges. I also want to agree that our interaction with the tertiary institutions, maybe we need to even strengthen that. But the Honourable Member has referred to the CITAS. Again, the issue of linkages and complementarity. But we also don't have to get into the agenda or to the mandate of the CITAS, but rather to look into those complementarities. How can we complement each other in as far as that is concerned? The where we are with the MDGs, it's not an easy question to respond to. And I think there has been acknowledgement at the highest office of the executive to say, unless we begin to measure differently, it will be difficult for us to say exactly where we are. There has been a lot of improvement that has happened, but in terms of quantifying whether we're at 20% or 30%, those are some of the challenges that we are currently dealing with. I am told that the presidency and SSA has actually been looking into those those parameters so that we can declare at some stage that this is where we are. So unfortunately, honorable member, I'll not be able to give you a precise response on that. The sustainability of the jobs, I think it depends which jobs we're talking to. If we talk to the EPWP jobs, mostly we look into job opportunities. Because most, as you know, EPWP type of project is very short-term in nature. It's a project that we are implementing. So the sustainability of it is relies on whether you have been able to effectively train people so that they are employable in other sectors, or for them to be able to start their own jobs. So the sustainability, it's not easy to link the sustainability to EPWP. But we're also looking into other interventions. We've spoken about the Jobs for Growth, for instance. We're also exploring the services sector, honorable members. Last week, I had a meeting with the DG of Justice, who was actually saying, I want to ring-fence this project, and I would like the IDC to assist me in implementing this project so that we can create sustainable jobs. The cleaning of courts outside, the environment of courts, the gardens, the maintenance of that, you can do that through co-op. The cleaning of the courts inside the courts themselves, he was saying, why can't we do that as co-op and give that as part of the allocation for Jobs for Growth? But you must implement it for us, because I don't have competent people to implement a Jobs for Growth type of a program. So those are some of the interactions that we are having. And if we can be able to create those co-ops, those are sustainable jobs. So it depends. The sustainability of the job depends on which job we are referring to. I think we have been quite successful in creating sustainable jobs through the services sector. If you look into EPWP and the home-based mandate, which is linked to that, which is more services, those are sustainable jobs that are coming out of that intervention. I'm saying, honorable, I can't say all the jobs that we intervene into are sustainable. Some are, some aren't. By its very nature, like for instance the EPWP type of intervention. Tom, was there anything you want to add?
Maybe through you, sir. I think the question of efficiency in terms of the investment that government makes in the IDT versus the value that the IDT brings across to the government. I want to refer the honorable member to page 71. Of the report. In fact, on page 71, we've got the income statement. What I want to highlight in the income statement is that the expenditure, if you look at the expenditure which is in brackets, excluding the income, it's roughly around 200 million. Now, if you put your finger there, you go to page 91. It's about 200 million expenditure, and that's all overhead included there. If you go to page 91, you've got program expenditure. Now, this is a very crude efficiency evaluation test. So, if you look at 200 million overhead versus 1.1 billion program expenditure, I think you come to around 19%. This excludes all of the other soft development aspects. It's one measure that one can use as a quick test of whether we're getting value or not. And in terms of that, I would say we certainly add in value.
And just to add to say the industry norm, if you look into the ratio of your direct and indirect, it can go to about 33%, which is about a third. So we are far below in terms of our efficiency ratio.
Will lead us to a decision. We will still have the same thing because we don't have questions. But apologize for that. Because we're so close to lunch, we cannot overindulge. So, in 5 minutes, we'll come back because I also need to make a decision call. So, thank you very much. Let's just have a 5 minute break.